Here's the Pioneer. That's the usual introduction to the weekly program of the Pioneer Cab Company. But tonight, perhaps we'd better say, here are two pioneers. We appreciate the fact that this country was first settled by women as well as men, although perhaps more men than women. Two of Alaska's early day homemakers are studio visitors tonight, Mrs. Dennis Coyle and Mrs. Blanche Cascaden. The Pioneer Cab Company has cooperated in providing time for us to visit with Mrs. Coyle and Mrs. Cascaden. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I believe we have Mrs. Cascaden lined up to come first on the interviews tonight. Mrs. Cascaden, I'm wondering, whatever made you decide to come to the Northland?
Well, my mother and father came up here. And my father thought it was a very good place to live, so he brought his family along.
Did he come with the intention of mining in the early days?
Yes.
About what year was that?
1900.
1900. And did you move right away to the interior, or did you live on the coast?
No, we came to Dawson.
You came to Dawson. Well, it's always interesting to know from the old-timers just how you got into the interior from the coast. Did you come over one of the passes?
No, we came down on a scow from Whitehorse.
Came down on a scow. How did you get up to Whitehorse? By railroad?
By railroad. From Skagway to Whitehorse by railroad.
What time of the year did you make the trip, Mrs. Cascaden?
September.
In September.
1900.
I imagine at that time that you found the weather quite favorable. I suppose the lakes and rivers were not frozen yet at that time.
No, they were beautiful.
I imagine. And what was the first picture that you got of Dawson when you arrived?
Well, it'd be rather hard to describe. It was wonderful. Everybody was in a great big hurry. The people seemed all young and healthy and strong, with plenty of money and ambition.
What were the buildings in Dawson like? I suppose they were more or less tacky affairs, weren't they?
Yes, they were, but they were very comfortable.
Was the town very large at that time? Would you say there were as many buildings as there are in Fairbanks right now?
Well, no, not quite as many buildings, but I believe there were as many people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would indicate that they were certainly crowded then in the early days of Dawson, Mrs. Cascaden. Well, let's see now. As a homemaker, what was your attitude about the early days in Dawson? Wasn't it pretty difficult to plan meals ahead and buy groceries, and wasn't food particularly expensive then?
Well, I guess it was, but I don't just remember about that.
Uh-huh. You were working in Dawson at that time?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In the restaurants, what were the prices of meals?
Well, the cheapest meal would be 75 cents, and then it would go up into the hundreds of dollars. Mm-hmm. The party given, it would come up to $500 or $600.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure our listeners will be interested to know, too, what you did after you left Dawson. How long did you live there?
I lived there about 3 years.
And then you moved to where?
Down to Eagle, Alaska.
How long were you at Eagle?
About 2 years.
2 years at Eagle, and that's on the Yukon, isn't it?
On the Yukon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then did you come to Fairbanks?
Came over the trail to Fairbanks.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. You say over the trail. What route did you use?
From Eagle overland in the winter.
Uh-huh. What year was that, do you recall?
1906.
Did you come by dog team? Or?
No, we had a horse and a double-ender.
I see. Yes, I've understood that in the early days they used horses and double-ender sleds. And, of course, I don't believe that there's one horse in operation up here in the North Country now, is there?
Oh, thank goodness.
Uh-huh. Well, that's easier on the horses, and I imagine everyone agrees that airplane transportation is much of an improvement. Well, Mrs. Cascaden, will you tell me something of Fairbanks in those early days? What sort of work were you engaged in here in Fairbanks? Homemaker?
Homemaking at that time.
Did you find that homemaking in the early days of Fairbanks was particularly difficult?
No, I won't say that. We took things as they came in those days. We didn't think it was a hardship. Everything was a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Did you live in a log cabin home at that time?
Yes, I lived in a log cabin. There was three or four of us probably, and we'd only have maybe from one or two rooms.
You know, Mrs. Cascaden, I've associated you with the country over around Livengood. When did you move over there for a while?
1918.
1918. I said for a while. Perhaps it was a bit longer than that. How long did you stay?
Well, I've been going back and forth ever since. 19.
I see. And You, I understand, too, are interested in roads in the territory. What have you done in that direction?
Well, it was so hard to get over to Livengood and back that I decided that we should have a road. And with the good help of my neighbors and people in Fairbanks, we have one of the best roads in the country today.
I see. I understand that.
I feel proud of it.
You certainly should be, because the road to Livengood certainly is a fine part of the road system of Alaska.
Sure is.
I wonder, unless you have some further thought for our listeners and your many pioneer friends here in the North Country, I think that pretty well covers the territory we had in mind. All right, well, thank you ever so much, Mrs. Blanche Cascaden, for coming up here on the program Here's a Pioneer. At the beginning, you'll recall, we promised not one, but two pioneers on this particular program, and my second guest tonight is to be Mrs. Dennis Coyle. And Mrs. Coyle, we're curious, of course, to know when you chose to come to the North Country.
Well, we came in July 1900.
You even picked a balmier month than Mrs. Cascaden had. What course did you choose to come into the territory?
Well, at that time, the railroad was not completed between Skagway and Whitehorse. And at Lake Bennett, we came down a little boat from there and down through into Lake Linderman. And then we caught the rail again and came into Whitehorse.
I imagine traveling in those days was particularly difficult. Any incidences along the way that are worthy of recalling?
Well, I hardly could remember that.
Mm-hmm. How many passengers were there in the boat with you?
Oh, there were quite a number. Of course, this boat from Whitehorse down was the regular Yukon packets that they have nowadays, too. Not quite as large, probably, as the Alaska and the Klondike that they've had in the recent years, but the Kaska and the Whitehorse and a few more that I just can't recall right now. But some of the old-timers will know.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Doyle, Coyle, did you come to the North Country as a gold seeker? Was that your intention?
No, my father came in over the Chilkoot Pass in 1897. And he came out by the way of St. Michael's in 1998. And then we came in 1900.
What was the social life in Dawson in those days like? Did they have a lot of dances and local affairs? Was there much community spirit?
Well, I lived on the Cricks for 2 years, and of course I was just a youngster not going to school at that time. And then the later years, of course, in 1904 and 5, why, we had lots of parties, and every week there was a dance. And twice a month that the Masonic Lodge gave a dance, and the Oddfellows. And of course we all went with our parents and had a wonderful time. And even our Reverend Pringle, George Pringle, which many of you remember, he always attended these dances also. But, of course, we quit at 12 o'clock, and we were to church the next morning.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I imagine that the early day pioneers were always busy making up their own forms of amusement in the way of dances and social affairs. You know, those of us Chechakos in Alaska are always impressed with the stories of the early day, shall we say, desperados. Was there a degree of lawlessness in those days, or is that more fantasy than fact?
Well, it's more fantasy, I think, because in the Canadian country, in the Dawson-Yukon Territory, the MPs, or Royal Canadians, were very strict up there. So we really had a very nice community.
Mm-hmm. Well, from the homemaking angle, then, about the price of groceries and the kinds of foods that were available, that's what I'd like to know about.
Well, we had all the canned foods that you have here today. And, of course, eggs and fresh produce was hard to get.
How did the groceries get into the interior of Alaska and Yukon Territory in those days?
Well, all the staple goods, that is, canned goods, was brought up from St. Michael's. And meat and such as that. And then in the spring of the year and late fall, the eggs and bacon and ham that they wanted to keep over for the winter was taken in by the way of Dawson.
Did that make the groceries far more expensive than they are now?
Well, I can't say that they did. I believe they were just about the same. And in fact, down at Ruby, where we have lived for so many years, we find it was much cheaper when the food was brought in by the way of St. Michael's.
Now, that might be an idea for the Alaska Development Board. Perhaps we should go back to bringing the food up the river by the boats. How about that?
Well, all the boats are off the river now. They're all gone to their happy hunting grounds.
Yes, I imagine that's something in Alaska's past that will never be recalled. When did you choose to move from Dawson over here into the Fairbanks country?
Well, in 1911, I went outside to the state of Washington, and I came back in 1917. And from then on, I have lived down in the Ruby camp.
Well,
and
Mrs.
that's
Cross,
pioneering down there.
I'll bet it is. What is it like down in Ruby?
Well, we certainly have lots of mosquitoes. And when I went there, we had no roads. That is to speak of, there was no automobile roads, or even could you go by teams. And we, one trip that I made going outside, why, I had to come from Poor Man to the Tamarack Landing, which was 11 miles to walk. Then we went down on a little gas boat. And if you look on the map and look up the Slatina River or the Novakakit River and then go down into the Yukon, you will find out that it's about 300 or 400 miles for us to make 60 miles overland.
Well, I'll certainly look that up right after the broadcast. Oh, Mrs. Coyle, I understand that you've made a number of trips to the States since you first came to Alaska. About how many do you remember?
Oh, I couldn't say how many trips I made to the States, but I do recall one that was quite memorable because it took me 33 days to go from Ruby to Seattle.
Now, that seems completely unreasonable. I think you'll have to explain that.
Of course, nowadays you can make it in a day and a half by plane. Well, we were taking the Canrick crew of the Carlisle Packing Company to the mouth of the river, and also the cold storage barge, which was later brought to Fairbanks here, with the meat for the summer. And then, oh, we had about 350 passengers on, and 11 barges hooked onto this one Seattle 3, that old boat. I don't know, I think it's down in St. Michael's now. And then when we got them settled at Androsky, why, we went on down at the mouth of the river at Kotlik, and we were froze in there for over a week. And finally got into St. Michael's and waited there for 4 days for the old Victoria to unload. And on this particular trip that the Victoria made up from Seattle, she had to have a dog team come out to meet the boat a mile and a half out from Nome. And the passengers went in that way. And then when we came back, why, we had to unload the produce for Nome and also Galvin Bay.
You said that you had gone outside to the States for 5 or 6 years. I'm wondering, what is your attitude toward life here in the Northland? Do you believe that you enjoy your days up here to the full? Do you find it comparable in enjoyment to life in the States?
Well, I do. I know the times that I've been out, I've always been very anxious to get back. I don't know, there's something about this country that seems to draw those that have lived here for so many years back again.
Well, if it's something about this country, I think it must be some of the most wonderful people in the world. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Well, that's true.
Mm-hmm. And let's see, any further thoughts that you might have for your pioneer friends who are listening tonight? Now is your opportunity. We have a few seconds left. You're a member of the Women's Pioneers, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Uh-huh.
And although I haven't been able to attend the lodge very often because we live down at Ruby, but the last 4 years, of course, I've been quite active in Pioneer Women.
I wonder how many women belong to the Pioneers here in Fairbanks, do you know?
How many do you?
Perhaps Mrs. Cascaden can help us.
I think there's about between 40 and 50, we'll say.
Uh-huh. Well, that supplies all the information, and I think it just about takes up all of our time. Our thanks now to Mrs. Dennis Coyle and Mrs. Blanche Cascaden, who have so kindly consented to appear on the program Here's a Pioneer. This is a weekly quarter hour of reminiscences brought to you by the Pioneer Cab Company. Joe Coble and the Pioneer staff hope you enjoy these weekly visits with the old-timers. Incidentally, the new telephone number of Pioneer Cab is East 10A, the old number with an added A, East 10A for a Pioneer Cab. Please be with us for another presentation of Here's a Pioneer next Wednesday evening at 7:30.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This evening, station KFAR takes the opportunity of acquainting you with one of our city's visitors. In our studios is a man representing the YMCA. And during the following few minutes, it is our pleasure to have an informal chat regarding our visitor's activities with the YMCA and the reasons for this visit to the territory. Well, welcome to Fairbanks, Mr. Lawrence B. Cairns.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas, and good evening to all of you.
Just how long have you been in the territory, Mr. Cairns, on this visit?
I arrived in Alaska about 2.5 weeks ago.
And your port of entry was where?
Anchorage.
At Anchorage, Alaska, and you spent, I understand, some time down there.
That's right. I spent about 2 weeks there. I spent a week or 10 days visiting various people in the community. Then I spent a few days waiting for a plane to get me over to Fairbanks.
That's a very common experience and has been here and throughout the territory in the past few weeks, which reminds me that while our weather here didn't give you much of a warm welcome, I hope that the reception you received from the residents of Fairbanks and Anchorage has more or less compensated for that cold welcome of the weather.
Well, that's very true. I've been tremendously impressed by the friendliness of the people in the territory, and that has made up a good deal for the coldness of the weather.
Well, now that we're more or less acquainted with your tour of the territory thus far, perhaps we'd better get more specific and let's see just exactly what your purpose for coming here is and what you're trying to do on this trip up here.
Well, Mr. Thomas, I'm program director for the Army and Navy Department of the YMCA with headquarters in New York. Have been working with young people, boys and girls, in the YMCA program for about 25 years. Quite a number of people in Alaska have been writing to us in New York asking questions about the YMCA, trying to find out whether or not the formation of YMCAs in some of these communities would be a good thing. As a result of these inquiries, and I must say as well, inquiries from the military, the National Board asked me to come to Alaska to find out at first hand the facts about how people live, what the community problems are, and that sort of thing. Also to talk with local residents and to interpret to them the YMCA, the whole business being an attempt to determine whether or not these local communities want to have and are in a position to develop YMCA programs themselves.
Now, on your tour, what cities in the territory do you plan on visiting other than Fairbanks?
I think that Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Ketchikan are the principal cities on my list to be visited.
Well, that is correct, and you probably will arrive at a pretty good conclusion there as to the feasibility of going ahead and furthering the activities that you've been invited up here to look into.
I think so. One of the encouraging things has been the tremendous interest that I have found amongst people in all walks of life, and I might say practically all ages as well. People are tremendously interested in what goes on in these communities, and it seems to me are very anxious to have for their young people all of the advantages and opportunities for leisure time activities that can be found in progressive communities anywhere.
Well, that's a very good point. I know that the YMCA has been doing a very excellent job in the States, and with the growth of the territory, it seems only logical that there would be an increase in the population as well, and of course that means that there will be children who oftentimes will have difficulty finding something to do to fill in those leisure moments. Now, as we move along here, it may be just a little bit early in the game as far as you are concerned. I neglected to ask you whether or not you'd already visited Juneau and Fairbanks, or Juneau and Ketchikan, I should say, but since your point of entry was Anchorage, I assume that Anchorage and Fairbanks have been your first two stops.
That is right. I plan to go back to Anchorage for a meeting there Monday night, and then I'm going back to Juneau, and I hope to be able to take that beautiful steamer trip down to Ketchikan on my way out.
Well, of course, this might be putting you on something of a spot, so to speak, but since you visited just Anchorage and Fairbanks so far and have been here but a few days, would it be putting you on a spot to ask you just what is the reception to your proposed outline of the feasibility of YMCA activities up here?
Well, perhaps I ought to back away from that just a minute and say that I did not come to the territory for the express purpose of attempting to organize YMCAs. The purpose was to find out what the situation is and to interpret the YMCA idea to people who might be interested. I can say quite frankly that in Anchorage, there seems to me to be every possibility that people there will want to organize a YMCA. Having been in Fairbanks but 2 days, it is certainly too early for me to form any conclusions. I could say, however, that there is a good deal of interest, and we're hoping at a meeting tomorrow night to be able to discuss the matter pretty fully. Perhaps I should tell you about this meeting. 8 o'clock tomorrow night, the meeting is called in the lounge of radio station KFAR. Invitations have gone out to leaders in practically all of the civic organizations in Fairbanks, and anyone in the community who is seriously interested in the possibility of programs such as the YMCA for the young people will certainly be welcome at that meeting.
And I would say it'd be a very good opportunity for them to express their opinion. So many times that people feel that they would like to further some activity, but because of a laxity on their part, fail to put in their opinion. So I'm glad you brought that meeting time and place up as you did. Now, when you leave Fairbanks, do you intend to go to Juneau, first of all?
Well, I will go to Juneau after returning to Anchorage for the meeting I mentioned a little earlier. The idea being to spend a day or two in Juneau and in Ketchikan talking with people who've been asking questions about possibilities of YMCA.
Well, now, in your tours around town, you've, of course, seen what facilities there are here for the entertainment of the troops here, and you are connected in some way, are you not, with the United Service Organizations also?
That is right. I have been a national staff person of USO for the past 5 years, and I want to say right now that I must congratulate Fairbanks on the splendid USO club that I have seen here. I have visited USO clubs in 46 of the 48 states of the Union, and I can say honestly that I have not seen one that appears to be better run and to offer more interesting and worthwhile activities for servicemen, and I might add, many of the community young people have also been caught up in that program.
Well, of course, since you've been here, this is digressing from our main subject just a moment. You've perhaps heard of the coming carnival up here. Will you be able to get any preview, shall we say, of the activities here? Have you planned any sort of a social activity for yourself while you're here?
Well, I'm sorry to say that I haven't been able to plan anything of that sort. I have, however, changed my schedule so as to permit me to remain over Sunday, and I'm hoping to see some of the famous dog races on that day.
Well, I hope that you'll be able to stay here long enough for that. It'd be a shame to come up here from New York City and not be able to see a dog team if you haven't already. I was here quite some time myself before I had that opportunity.
Well, I'd certainly hate to go out of the territory without seeing at least one dog team in action, I assure you that.
Well, you'll certainly have something, if you don't, to keep you busy describing the weather up here when you get back to New York City, because it's my understanding that this is one of the coldest, the longest sustained cold spell, that is, for many and many a year up here. Even the old-timers say that's just too cold for them. Well, I understand that you expect to visit the little show the USO is putting on at the Empress Theater Sunday afternoon, and I might further what you just said there about the facilities they have for the recreation of the boys here at the post and the soldiers in the vicinity, with the fact also that there's a lot of good local talent here in town. I've heard some of them practicing over at the USO, and they'll all be appearing on this show at the Empress Theater Sunday, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it very much.
Well, I'm certainly anxious to see and hear that performance.
Now, I think it might be well if you'll review again, for the benefit of our listeners, the meeting that you mentioned just a little bit earlier. I think that'll bear repeating.
The invitation has gone out to representatives of all of the civic organizations. If any have been missed, we apologize to them, but we hurry to say that they are invited to attend this meeting. It will be at 8 o'clock tomorrow night in the lounge at station KFAR, and on this occasion I hope to be able to describe somewhat in detail how a YMCA gets started and how it functions, what it might mean to a community, and then to give everybody plenty of opportunity to ask questions so that we can discuss the idea just as fully as the people want to discuss it.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Carnes. Our time, of course, is limited on the radio, but we're glad to have had this opportunity for a preview of what you intend outlining to the people at this meeting. And with that, our thanks to you, Mr. Carn, for coming to the studio this afternoon and outlining briefly just exactly what you intend to discuss at this meeting. That's 8 o'clock tomorrow night, and it'll be in the lounge of KFAR.
That is right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carnes.
Thank you, sir.
You have just heard a brief interview with a city's visitor, Mr. Lawrence B. Carnes, for the past 5 years, National Director of the Program Service for the 450 USO clubs and permanent Army and Navy branches operated by the YMCA. We've had an opportunity again over KFAR to acquaint you with one of our city's visitors. And thank you again, Mr. Carnes, for the information you've given us, and we hope that everyone interested in what is to be said regarding YMCA activities here will try to make it a point to come to this meeting and express their opinions.
Ladies and gentlemen, here's a pioneer. Historic moments of adventure, discovery, and a dash of humor from Alaska's past, told to you by the men who made them, and brought to you by the pioneers in personalized transportation in the interior, the Pioneer Cab Company of Fairbanks. Now, for a quick flashback to Alaska's past, here's a pioneer. And tonight is Mr. Andrew Nerland. Mr. Nerland, shall we begin by asking you when you first came to Alaska?
In the spring of 1898.
Will you tell us, what was your home down in the States?
In Seattle, Washington.
How about the story of how you first came to Alaska?
Well, during the summer of 1898, the steamer Portland came into Seattle from Alaska, from St. Michael, and it carried presumably about $1 million worth of gold dust, which had been mined up in the Klondike. And that was principally the reason that I got ready to go to Dawson or the Klondike.
I guess that made quite a bit of excitement down around Puget Sound at that time.
Yes, it did. It really electrified every community around there and every individual, as far as that's concerned.
And it really didn't take you very long to decide to come north.
No, it didn't. Of course, it took a little longer to get things together so I could come in some sort of a shape.
Will you tell us what means of transportation you chose to get up here, and what was the first point in Alaska that you touched?
We came on a steamer from Seattle to Dyea, and from there we started to pull our outfit along the Dyea Trail up to Sheep Camp.
Dyea is not very far from Skagway, is it?
No, just a few miles.
Oh, you pulled a sled?
Oh, yes.
With a strap around your neck? Is that the way it went?
Well, something like that.
Uh-huh. And you went up to Sheep Camp. How far was that from Dyea?
I think around about 20 miles.
It's about 20 miles. Was there anything particularly exciting about your trip over Chilkoot Pass?
Well, no, after we got to Sheep Camp, we had to lighten our loads on the sleds and pull it up to a place called the Scales. From there on, all the provisions had to be carried on a man's back. One thing happened while I was there, that was the big slide there that took place the first part of April in 1898.
Snow slide?
Yes. About 63 people were killed there in that slide.
Mm-hmm. Will you tell us a little bit more about that? Where were you when the slide occurred, and how did you happen to hear about it, and just exactly what happened there?
Well, we had our camp down at Sheep Camp, and this particular day being Sunday, and also that the weather was very heavy and very lot of snow was falling. So we decided not to go out that day. But it was a lot of people at the Scales that also commenced to get leery about the slides. And it said that about 100 people held on to a rope and started on for Sheep Camp. But they were caught by slide long before they reached Sheep Camp.
The whole side of the mountain moved down there all at once.
That's about it, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did they get all the bodies out?
Yes, the number of people that didn't get caught in the slide. But all the bodies were eventually dug out. Everybody that were camping around there pitched in and dug out the snow or the pile of slide so they could get at all the bodies. And they did get all the bodies, which proved in the spring that there were none left there.
I see. Now, as I understand it, you left from Dyea near Skagway and went up over Chilkoot Pass and then down the other side to the Lake Bennett section, wasn't it?
That's right.
Uh-huh. How long, how many traveling days do you imagine elapsed between Dyea and Lake Bennett? That must have been a long, long trip.
Well, I think perhaps about 24 days.
Mm-hmm. I imagine the travelers along the way were particularly interesting. Of course, they were all Chechakers. And were there any women in the travelers?
Oh, yes, there were some women. Mm-hmm.
Any children at all?
Well, a few. Not very many, though.
Very few. A pretty tough trip for children.
Well, yes, it was rather tough.
Mm-hmm. Pretty hard to predict what was coming up. how did you make out when you got down to Lake Bennett? Were things pretty agreeable there? It was in the spring. I imagine the climate was with you.
Oh, yes, it was very nice. Clear weather on Lake Bennett, and we made camp in a place where we could get lumber for our boat that everybody had to build, and it was thousands of people there doing the same thing.
You really had a lot of company. I suppose they built some strange-looking craft, too.
They did. That's right.
Did some of them build rafts?
Oh, yes, rafts, too. But mostly some kind of a boat. All shapes around, some of them nearly round, and some of them square, and some of them regular boats. Mm-hmm. Some very nice boats.
I see. And then as soon as the ice in Lake Bennett went out, then you proceeded downstream in the direction of Whitehorse. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Any particular difficulties in getting to Whitehorse and then on to Dawson?
Well, of course, we got down to Whitehorse Rapids. That had been sort of a scare in everybody's mind. And, of course, there was just hundreds and hundreds of boats waiting at the head of the rapids to go through. Everybody went down to take a look and came back, got their boats, those that thought they could go through, and sail on through. And others again got pilots to take them through, but evidently they all got through some way or other.
Mm-hmm. What about your trip through the rapids? How long did it take, and was it particularly rough?
No, I wouldn't say that. It was not any more than what we expected, having looked over the rapids beforehand. We sailed through there quite nicely in about 10 minutes.
Oh, I see. That's all it took. Did you see anyone else in difficulty?
Yes, there had been a crash there against a rock right in the center of the Whitehorse Rapids. Some boat had smashed right against the rock, and one of the men had saved himself by hanging on to the rock, and he was still there when we came by.
And I imagine due to the condition of the water and so on, you didn't have much time to stop and pick him up.
No, we didn't.
Now, moving on to Dawson, how did you find Dawson when you got there? Pretty well developed, a big population?
A lot of people there, tremendous lot of people. The streets were crowded with men, and going out on the creeks, all the trails were crowded, just almost like on a city sidewalk, big city sidewalk. Just continuous flow of people.
I imagine there was a terrific housing problem then.
Oh, yes, everybody lived in tents. They all had their tents long. Lived in tents.
What about the food? I heard there were a few cases of scurvy there in the spring of 98.
Yes, there were a few cases of scurvy. Although I don't think very serious, but of course fresh food started to come in then by people hauled food all the way from outside over the trail with horses right into Dawson.
You know, we talk about the high cost of air transportation. I imagine if somebody had to carry it by hand on a sled all the way from Dai or some such place, it really would be expensive. What were the prices like?
Well, the prices for instance, a can of milk was selling for $1. And different other, most other items ran along about the same price.
How about eggs? And,
well, I noticed one thing. One of the first days I was in Dawson, I walked down one of the waterfront streets there, and I saw a barge, like quite a large barge, scow landed along the waterfront there, and I happened to see a sign on the this barge. It was made with a marking brush. It says, eggs, $300 a case. And I was wondering if that fellow thought that was a joke or how he put it on there. But anyway, I went out on the creeks. We'd gone for about 3 weeks walking over the different creeks. And I got back. That struck out the 300 and said eggs, 150 a case.
Well, I can see that the inflation period was over then.
That was right, yeah.
Did you take a hand at prospecting yourself?
Well, not just then. I did later on. I did no prospecting in 98, excepting going on stampedes and so forth, and probably stake some claims that later on perhaps didn't develop.
I did. I'm wondering how the rest of the newcomers to Dawson in that vicinity made out. Any particular stories about that?
Well, remember one story they were telling right along that all the Chichaukas, most of them in a way, were anxious to get hold of some mining ground, and they didn't care where it was, just so that they could have some kind of a claim. It seemed like the story goes that about two or three Chichaukas came along up Bonanza Creek and they talked to one of the old prospector, old miners there. He was working his claim there in the summer. And they asked him, do you know where we can get some mining ground? And the old timer, he was going to put him off. And he said, yeah, right up there on that high hill up there. Because at that time, nobody had ever thought of discovering any gold up on those high hills. But anyway, the Chichaukas took him literally, and they went up there, started to dig, and they dug and dug, and it finally developed into one of the richest mining hills in the country. Millions was taken out of there.
I see. Now, will you tell us where you met Mrs. Nerland?
Well, I met her. I'd met her in Seattle a number of years before I came north.
Well, then you made a trip out there shortly after you came up.
Made a trip out in the fall of 99.
Mm-hmm. Leslie was born here in the north, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was born in Dawson.
In Dawson. Mm-hmm. What year did you come to Fairbanks from Dawson?
1904. Spring of 1904.
Was there any activity over here in 1904?
Oh, yes, I'd say it was.
How many people do you imagine we had here?
A lot of people here, too. The steamboats coming in here were all crowded with people. And the streets here were crowd of the people, and they were out on the creeks here, same as they did in Dawson, look over mining ground, and a lot of them found mining ground.
I understand in those days the center of population was not only Fairbanks, but here in the outlying districts, just within a few miles.
Yeah, the creeks out here at Clear Creek and Chattanooga and Goldstream and Doom Creek. There were a lot of people there, and there were big operations there. Lots of individual mining concerns, and so that hired a lot of men. So those camps, they were quite lively centers.
And there was a railroad running out to Chattanooga.
Yes.
And didn't you say there were a couple of banks at Cleary, just about 25 miles out here?
Yes, that's right. At one time, I believe it was three branch banks at Cleary, branches from the banks here in this town.
Those are the things about the old days that are really hard to believe now. Well, I think we've covered the past. I'd like to talk for just a few seconds about the future. I might say that Mr. Nerland In his years here in Fairbanks, has served as councilman and mayor and also on the legislature. Mr. Nerland, what idea do you have about Alaska's future on the basis of your experience of almost 50 years in the North?
Well, I always have had great faith in Alaska, and I still have that faith. And I'm not afraid to gamble the balance of my life in staying with it and see whether great things are coming through. But whether they are or not, why, I have found it a wonderful, satisfactory place in which to do business and to live. The people here for all the years past are wonderful people, and it's interesting to live in a place where you know a lot of people, both that comes into your store or that you meet on the street. And I have great faith in Alaska's future.
All right. Our thanks to you, Pioneer Andrew Nerland, for this interlude of reminiscence. We imagine that the name of Nerland will be well known in Fairbanks for many generations.
I think so.
And thanks to you, too, from Joe Coble of the Fairbanks Institution, whose 3 decades of service here have made it a pioneer in fact as well as in name, the Pioneer Cab Company. Friends, be with us again next Wednesday for another quarter hour of sourdough tales and the reminder that here's a pioneer.
Here's a Pioneer, a presentation of Pioneer Cab. The local cab company that dates back to the early days brings you the weekly 15 minutes of reminiscence known as Here's a Pioneer. Joe Coble and the Pioneer Cab staff, who make this salute to the old-timers possible, hope you'll enjoy this program of recollection and comment. So, here is tonight's Pioneer of the Week, one known to so many of you, Dick Rothenberg. Dick, I suspect that you've been in the North Country for a good long time. How long would that be?
Be 50 years next June.
Next June, and that will be a real anniversary for you. I imagine it will call for a lot of celebration. I wonder what you called home down in the States.
Well, I call Seattle my home.
And what was the occasion for your coming to the territory? What made you decide?
My old partner, Julius Strook, had some friends in Alaska, and they advised him to come to the 40 Mile. That was before the Klondike strike was established.
You know. I imagine you were a pretty young man at that time.
I was 26 years old.
And full of the yearning for adventure. Will you tell us something of the means of transportation that you chose to come to Alaska?
Well, we came on the old steamer Elkai to Dyea. Of course, Skagway hadn't been established yet, and we came, about 10 days after the first contingent crossed the Chilkoot Pass, and this contingent consisted of miners from the southeastern Alaska vicinities, and no one outside, that is the steamer Portland, hadn't arrived yet, and the strike of the Klondike hasn't been published yet. So we were all alone on the trail.
All alone on the trail. Well, Mr. Rothenberg, I'd like to sit back for a few moments and really let you relive in words the experiences of coming up over Chilkoot Pass. Will you tell us about that?
Well, as I said, we were all alone and we didn't know the trail, but my partner had bought a book in Seattle written by Miner Bruce. I think some of the ladies in town will still remember Mrs. Bruce and her daughter, principal of the school in Seattle. The book was pretty good. It gave the distances, you know, and we could judge ourselves by going through the different lakes and until we came to the principal places, the places that were really dangerous, you know. Well, we crossed the Chilkoot Pass, and it was wet snow, blowing, blizzard, and we got pretty good and wet. And we camped at Green Lake, and there we had our first accident. We
established a camp there, and our shoes were wet and clothes wet, so we started a big campfire and tried to dry our shoes. And my partner's left shoe and my right shoe burned up, so we were with just one pair of shoes and one pair of gum boots. So we took turns about wearing the shoes one day and the boots the other day. Well, anyway, we got back to Lindeman, and we cut logs, we cut trees, and we cut them into logs, and we whipsawed lumber and built a boat. Then there's a passage between Lindeman and the next lake that's very dangerous. We caught up with two brothers. They had lost their outfit before and had gone back to Juneau and bought another outfit. Well, as it happened, they lost the second outfit. And one of the brothers was so disheartened, he went back to his tent, took his gun, and shot himself through the head. We buried him right on the shores of Lindeman. He had a nice blanket and a piece of canvas, and we wrapped him up, and we buried him right there. His other brother went back to Juneau again.
I imagine that your trip into the country at that time actually preceded the great hordes that were to come later.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We were...
That was 97, and what was the month that you made the trip over the pass?
In June.
In June.
Yes. The Portland didn't get out till July. That is the steamer Portland that carried the first virgin gold from Alaska, you know. It didn't get there. But then the second rush started. Well, anyway, we crossed the lakes, and as I said, we had Minor Bruce's guide. It was pretty good, and we crossed Lake LaBarge, Windy Arm, as they call it, you know, wasn't bad with us, but I heard afterwards that there were several outfit lost at that place that they call the Windy Arm. Then we crossed into Mud Lake, and then we had a lookout for the canyon. Well, we passed into the little opening that really made the Yukon River, and we seen the water was very, very swift, black, you know, and a big comb in the center, and of course we were looking for the canyon. We went along, and finally I seen a pair of red drawers hanging up in a tree, and I said to Julius, by gosh, I said, that's a danger sign. Pull to the shore. Well, we came to the shore, and sure enough, there about just about a quarter of a mile, there was a canyon. And the canyon was a bad place. My partner said, well, I'm going to take a look. Will you come along? I says, no. I says, I've got all I can stand right now. And he went. He came back in a few minutes. I says, did you see it? Yes. He says, I seen all I wanted to see. And he started taking off his boots. I says, what are you going to take your boots off for? You can't swim in this water. Well, he says, I'm not going to die with my boots on. Well, that was very encouraging, of course. And so we started. Well, you know, the canyon is divided. The canyon is a mile long. And right in the center, there's a big whirlpool. A whirlpool about 150 yards in diameter. And it's a merry-go-round, and you've got to go if you're in it. And you're going fast. And if you slip off of the comb, as we call it, you're in the whirlpool.
I imagine during the month of June it was particularly high, too.
No, it was low water, and that's what made it bad, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, we slipped off of the comb, and we went one half turn around. And when we got back to the opening again, I told Julius, now I says, pull, and pull all you can, and we slipped through. Well, we came through the canyon, and there was a series of rapids right below the canyon. But Miner Bruce didn't mention them. But afterwards, I found out that they were called the Squaw Rapids. So, naturally, we thought, you know, the first rapids that we would encounter would be the White Horse. And we congratulated ourselves, you know, going through the White Horse. But we hadn't gone but about a half a mile when the river made an abrupt turn, a right-angled turn. And say, it looked like one of those ski trails that you put up here at the college. You could look down white water for about 2 miles and going. Well, Julius must have seen that there was something wrong with me. You know, he was facing me. You know, he was rowing. You have to row, you know, in order to keep headway so you can have steering way. And he looked over his shoulder and he says, Jesus Christ. And he started to pull. Well, you know, when we reached the White Horse, I couldn't see a thing. The foam was way up above your head. The rocks on each side like shark teeth, but I happened to hit the center of it and we went through. But right below the White Horse Rapids, the water is very calm, nice, you know, just before you get into Lake Bennett. So Julius says, well, let's land. And we landed. He got out, and I sit there. And he says, come on. I says, wait a minute. I couldn't get up, you know. I was so darn scared. My knees were shaking. I couldn't get up. Well, anyway, we crossed Lake Labarge, Lake Bennett, and into the 30 Mile. The 30 Mile, after, I didn't find it very dangerous, but I heard that the next year a good many outfits were lost in it, you know. But we went along till we struck the Five Finger. Now, Miner Bruce didn't mention which, you know, there's three passages in the Five Fingers. And he didn't mention which passage would be the safest. So, of course, we took the middle passage, which was the wrong passage. But we got through all right. We shipped a lot of water, and we went through. Then we floated down the Yukon until we come to the mouth of the Klondike, and there we seen a lot of tents and men walking on the beach on the banks there, and we landed, and there was Dawson, and we stayed there. We mined there. We, afterwards, the big rush came through. The provisions were very scarce. The NET&T company shut their doors and wouldn't sell anything. Some people had ordered their outfit this early in the spring, some of the old 40-milers and 60-milers and 70-milers ordered their outfit early in the spring, but all they could get was one sack of flour, 15 pounds of bacon, and 10 pounds of beans.
Mr. Rothenberg, what were the prices like back in those days?
Well, the prices were, of course, all right until the scarcity of grub was filled. When the second rush came through, there were so many of them, a big percentage, that were discouraged and went right along down to St. Michael and sold their outfits. Well, they had picks and shovels and whipsaws and rifles and sacks of flour, and every pound was $3 a pound. In order to get a sack of flour, you had to buy the whipsaws and the pick and shovels and gold pans and rifles and weigh everything up for $3 a pound. So a sack of flour would cost you, well, it was supposed to cost you $150, but by the time you bought everything that they had, why, it cost you quite a bit. So that way, the provisions were very high, And candles. Candles were about a dollar a piece, about $120 for 10 dozen candles. Well, there was an amusing incident happened.